Thank you so much for joining us here on Wisconsin Public Radio News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about some of the earliest life forms that used to live right here in Wisconsin. Couple of guests for you today. One of our guests is Scott Schaefer. He's interim director of the Weiss Earth Science Museum at the UW Oshkosh Fox Cities campus. Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it very much. Our other guest, Ken Gass, back with us. He's an honorary curator at Milwaukee Public Museum, specializes in Paleozoic life in Wisconsin. And Ken, good to have you back with us.
Great to be back. Thank you.
As we talk with these two experts, I hope you'll join in. Maybe you could share your favorite facts about our state's natural history. Have you visited maybe the Earth Science Museum recently? Have you found something from a long, long ago, maybe a fossil in your area, maybe right on your own property? Love to hear from you. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk at WPR.org. That's talk at WPR.org. Ken, just start with you for a minute, and Paleozoic, what does that term really mean?
Well, that is a period of time that was marked the first animal fossils and the first explosion of life on the planet, as far as the fossil record goes. It was about, I would say, well, let's see, what is, I'm looking at my notes here just to make sure I get the right amount of time here. But the Cambrian was the first period of it, and that one started about 538 million years ago, so it's well over half a billion years ago. And we do have animal and plant life from the Cambrian period here in Wisconsin. So it's I could tell you more about that. I've done two programs on it on the show here already, but I can definitely give you some more stuff about that as far as some really great discoveries that were found here.
It's really cool. And I think the question that always comes to mind right off the bat is, how in the heck do we know what we know about the Paleozoic area and life so long ago?
Fossils, mostly. That is the record of life, basically, going all the way back. And we've got an abundance of those throughout most of the Paleozoic, not all of it, but like at least two-thirds of the Paleozoic, and then a very big gap, the Mesozoic era, which is the era following the Paleozoic. We had virtually nothing. There was one little formation called the Windrow in the Cretaceous, which is, of course, the time of the dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have any dinosaurs from Wisconsin, although they were probably alive here. It's just that we had this little thing going through called the glaciers, and there was a lot of other erosion before that as well that just kind of scraped away, bulldozed away most of the Mesozoic rocks. So we don't have any dinosaurs here. So interesting stories about that. There is a gizzard stone that was found out west, and the rock from it was traced back to possibly being from Wisconsin. So there might have actually been a dinosaur that picked that rock up from Wisconsin, as they would anything for their, you know, in the gizzard stones, and went back to out west. And when it died, its gizzard stone was preserved next to its bones, and that stone was probably from Wisconsin. So we kind of figured that there were dinosaurs here, regardless of that. But just so far, no bones have been found or any other fossil remains of dinosaurs.
It's how is our understanding? I'm just wondering, this geological time scale, has our understanding of it changed much, let's say, over the last century or so?
I'd say the main thing is I noticed in my lifetime, it seems that we've pushed back the scale a little further, just with more refined techniques of dating things. There's been quite a while that we've had a lot of development in the dating techniques with potassium argon for the younger fossils and uranium decay for the oldest ones. And that kind of indicates what the absolute age is of these events.
Really cool. And what can we see and observe here in Wisconsin in particular?
Well, we can see a lot of the Paleozoic rocks. As well, of course, as Scott can tell you more about the Pleistocene, especially the Ice Age type sediments. And of course, the rocks are all different kinds. We have, as far as the life goes, the oldest life that we have preserved is in fossils in Wisconsin goes back about a little over a billion years, and that was in the form of stromatolites, which are a type of bacteria. So this is before there were any plants or animals on the Earth. But in Wisconsin, we do have some of these stromatolites, which are a type of a bacteria that would secrete a slimy substance, and then the sediment that was falling down on top of it would stick to it, and then you'd have one layer after another, so they were very thin laminations, just a big dome. It doesn't look like too much, but that was the kind of life that we had.
It's really interesting. Scott, maybe I want you to chime in for sure. Maybe first, let me just ask you to talk a bit about the Weiss Museum itself and what people can find there.
Sure. The Weiss Earth Science Museum, we're located, like you introduced us here, at the UW-Oshkosh Fox Cities campus. And we are Wisconsin's official mineralogical museum. We were designated that upon opening. And we do have a lot of exhibits and features that highlight the geological processes that have shaped our state over its roughly 2.8 billion years of history.
That's really, really cool. And your area of concentration, talk about it for a bit.
My background is in paleontology. Sort of like your other guest, Ken, I am quite partial to the Paleozoic, which we do have represented quite well across the state. But working within my discipline, especially at the Weiss Museum, I kind of have to know a little bit about the breadth of the geologic history. And so I'm definitely looking into expounding a bit on some of our Ice Age deposits that we have as well. But we have beautiful representations of a lot of this throughout our adorable little museum that we have.
That is very, very cool. Ken, I know you wrote a book about the Milwaukee form, what's called the Milwaukee Formation. And I thought it was kind of cool because there's cement companies involved in this.
Yeah, I wrote a book about it, so it's too much to talk about to get into detail. But yes, and that is a sequence of rock. The Milwaukee Formation is a sequence of rock strata or layers that contain the fossils of the life that was alive at that time, and which was the age of the fishes. So a lot of the fossils that you'll find there, although they're kind of rare, but when you find them, they're very conspicuous, are from fish of various kinds, very strange kinds. We had the big, the arthrodeer called Eastmonasteus, which is about the size of a great white shark that was swimming around in Milwaukee at that time. And this was about 385 million years ago. And lots of other different kinds of fish, sharks, very simple, primitive sharks, nothing real specialized. And then it was also the age of the brachiopods, and I know that's one of the little subspecialties that Scott has. He might want to talk more about that, but brachiopods and a lot of the other more common animals that used to live in the Devonian seas, that's the age of the period that we're talking about. Trilobites, corals, echinoderms, things like that that all lived at that time. But I think the most exciting things are the things that people at least perk up the most about are these Prototaxites, which is a giant fungus that was the size of a tree. And that is, at the earlier part of the Devonian, that was the tallest organism on Earth, was a fungus. Imagine a mushroom the size of a tree, a fairly large tree, as a matter of fact. And so that, and then lots of other, like I said, the fish were very conspicuous when they were present, and there were some very big and some were just grazers and filter feeders and all different kinds of fish that were around in the age of the fish, the Devonian.
Mark in Bloomer has a comment for us. Let's go there. Mark, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah. So I was a few years back a member of a geological society up in Cameron, and we went on a field trip out to the farm. This farmer had all kinds of glaciated rock in his field. And our jaws hit the ground. We couldn't believe all the things we were finding. And his jaw hit the ground. He couldn't believe we wanted it. He said, "You want more? Take all you want." It was, his nuisance was our treasure. It was crazy.
Oh, man. Is Scott, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, our state has been impacted so heavily by the last major glaciation during the Ice Age that the last phase of the Ice Age is called the Wisconsinian, or the Wisconsin Glaciation. As those glaciers bulldozed their way through the state between about 30,000 to about 12 to 15,000 years ago, they sampled many rocks from up on the Canadian Shield, north of Lake Superior, through the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and of course sampling things across the state as it traversed its way through. And among those debris can be found any number of things that are just visiting the state. We have, in our museum, for example, at the Weiss Museum, we have a chunk of float copper, not that it floats, but it was rafted in the ice debris that was found in the center of the state, and it weighs about 400 pounds. So you can find any number of treasures amongst the glacial deposits, including locally derived rocks as well, especially along the beaches of Lake Michigan.
Yeah.
I might add to that life as well. Of course, we have the traditional mastodons and mammoths and elk, bison, things like that. A lot of those that were alive at that time and then either became extinct soon after that or hung on for a little while into the next period. But, yeah, a lot of different kinds of things. And even there were some in Lake Michigan, in large Lake Michigan, which was in existence right after the glaciers melted away, there were actually sperm whales, walruses, sea turtles found in Michigan. They haven't been found in Wisconsin yet, but they were probably here, you know, since Lake Michigan covered all this, a lot of the states. And so there was a lot of life, a lot of change going on as soon as that happened. Then the glaciers melted and the life pretty much returned to what it is pretty much right now.
Yeah. What the continents looked a whole lot different.
In the Paleozoic, there were a lot of different plates that were moving around. And most of the Paleozoic had North America and, the Devonian time, there was something called Euramerica, and that was North America and Western Europe. And before that, it was Laurentia, which was North America, Greenland, and Scotland, and they were all together as one supercontinent. So things were different. It's hard to say, like when somebody says, what was life like in Milwaukee or in Madison at that time? You'd have to say, well, how old was the rock that we're talking about? Because the rock kind of moves around with the plates, you know. but that's really what we're talking about is the plates moving around a lot. But the inland seas are the things that were always present in the Paleozoic time when most of the rocks were deposited here in Wisconsin.
We're going to talk some more about that with our two guests today, Ken Gass, honorary curator at Milwaukee Public Museum, specializes in the Paleozoic life of Wisconsin, and Scott Schaefer, interim director of the Weiss Earth Science Museum at UW Oshkosh Fox Cities campus. I'm Larry Miller. You're listening to WPR News. We are traveling back in time to Wisconsin in the Paleozoic area with our two guests today, Larry Miller here, and our guest, Ken Gass, honorary curator at Milwaukee Public Museum, and Scott Schaefer, interim director of the Weiss Earth Science Museum at UW Oshkosh Fox Cities campus. Questions for them as we move along, or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. You know, our state, we have a state fossil. Does every state, Scott, do you know if every state has a state fossil?
Many states have an official state fossil, but not all states. And we do happen to have a beautiful specimen called of a type of trilobite called Gravicolimini salibra. And you can find that in our Silurian period rocks around the eastern portion of the state, hugging Lake Michigan.
Trilobites, I always thought of it as trilobites, but it's trilobites is how it's pronounced?
Trilobites.
Trilobites. Sorry. Trilobites. I'll get it right sooner or later.
Three lobes.
Somewhere it's in the back of my head. I'm remembering that it sort of has a relative in a way, or at least the animal that is most closely associated with it is the horseshoe crab. Is that?
You know, that's still considered to be the closest living relative of trilobites. But of course, all the trilobites did become extinct at the end of the Paleozoic. But yeah, that's actually correct. Yeah,
That's cool.
They superficially resemble the sow bugs or isopods. So when they were frightened or endangered, they're threatened. They would roll up for protection. Many of those species, and our state fossil is one that could do that. Although they're rarely encountered that way, rolled up.
Right. The horseshoe crab is closer, though, genetically, or we think it was.
We think so anyway. Jeff and Barry Mills has something for us. Hi, Jeff. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Years ago, I was doing some excavating to make an addition to the house south of La Crosse along the Coon Creek watershed. And it was a clay knoll and red clay, and you'd find gray streaks. And I was about 6-8 feet into the ground, and it was devoid of any rocks. And I came up with about a fist-sized cinder, just a black, shiny, like a coal cinder. And it was just about the only rock I found in there. And I was just wondering if it was of any significance, or you could tell me, you know, what was the origin.
Scott, you have that?
That material was very likely brought down by the glaciers. The area around La Crosse has a lot of Paleozoic limestones and sandstones, things that date to the Cambrian and the Ordovician period. But basalt, which is what a lot of the material that people refer to as cinders, basalt or scoria, are known from areas further north of there from what was called the Mid-Continental Rift. There was a time when Wisconsin and Minnesota almost parted ways and decided to form two separate continents. So that volcanic material likely originated from there.
Oh, really interesting. Jeff, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. When we're talking about these continents drifting around or Minnesota and Wisconsin moving around, what kind of a time period? It's not like they just up and left overnight.
We're talking about geological time, and it was even for geological time, these things take millions of years to move. In fact, it's almost on a daily basis. It's just a fraction of a millimeter in most cases. But it's with so much geological time, of course, that you can do a lot of movement in that time in billions of years. But I know that there was considerable movement like at in the Devonian, between the Silurian and the Devonian, there seemed to have been more continents moving around at that time. Like I said, through the Cambrian, Ordovician, Silurian, they were pretty much the same as far as the mass that had North America in it. But there were some
also worth mentioning. It's almost worth mentioning we were south of the equator at that time.
Right.
There we were, south of the equator. Oh, my goodness me.
Yeah, through the Paleozoic, it was all pretty much subtropical, as far as the climate.
Oh, my gosh. Mike in Sealy has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mike.
Well, I never thought that my rock might have been south of the equator, but anyway, on the property here, we've got just the top edge of a real smooth, big piece of rock. And I've always wondered where that might have come from. Now, this was logging area, too, but I don't think they would have moved this rock. Any ideas?
Glaciers, probably, since they can move mountains virtually, bulldoze away large masses of rock and pieces of the continent. They can pretty much grind it down into a meal, and they can move rocks hundreds of miles. Mm-hmm. And boulders bigger, as tall as a room, can be easily moved by some of the glaciers. So I don't doubt that that's a good chance that was moved by a glacier.
Yeah.
Maybe from where? North of here? Or?
Well, I would have to look at the rock to see what kind of rock it is. And most of the glaciers did come from a northerly direction, but some western, and there were different lobes coming down at different glacial stages, but we'd have to look at all of that.
Might have come from Canada, in other words.
It could have. There's a lot of rocks that have come down from Canada.
Yeah. And what color is the rock, by the way? Is it an unusual?
Oh, it's sort of a grayish with, okay. you know, a little bit lighter, and it's really smooth. It's been here forever, I'm sure.
Depending where you're located, you might be seeing a rock that has itself been glacially scoured. As it sort of ran over, well, I'm familiar with the Milwaukee area, as it sort of bulldozed through the Milwaukee area, that rock itself might contain scratches from small fragments of rocks trapped between the ice and the bedrock itself that will indicate what direction the ice was even flowing, which is one of the fascinating things that we have here with our ice age deposits.
Interesting. Thanks, Mike. And at one point, we were underwater, weren't we, in Wisconsin?
Oh yes, yeah. And most of the state was submerged for a great part of the Paleozoic era. I mean, we were near the sea in some cases. In fact, in the Cambrian period, we were right on a seashore, basically the edge of the landmass that was covering that was where Wisconsin is now. And there were large inland seas that would come up over the land, and the life would follow it, and the fossils, of course, would follow. And that's pretty much what most of the fossils are that you'll find in the Paleozoic were marine animals and plants, mostly marine animals, and stromatolites. Like I said, those are going through all along, and those are bacteria.
And there was quite a almost what you'd call a mass extinction that occurred at some point. Scott, maybe go to you for that.
Yeah, we've had actually a few mass extinctions that came through. Our rocks in Wisconsin don't specifically record those events. They're not from the specific windows of time, but there have been mass extinction events that occurred at the end of the Ordovician period. There was another one at the end of the Devonian, and most people are familiar with the one that wiped out the dinosaurs, thinking that that was the largest. But in fact, the marker for the end of the Paleozoic era was, in fact, the Great End Permian mass extinction, which was part of my research for my grad program. But that one is often referred to as the Great Dying, and we don't have rocks from that period, though.
So do we know what happened?
Over 90%. I'm sorry. Over 90% of the species were wiped out during that extinction, during the end Permian extinction, and I think it was also in the same ballpark with the one that wiped out the dinosaurs the end Permian one, which is the beginning. I'm sorry, the end of the Cretaceous. That was another extinction event, which wiped out the last of the dinosaurs. And it wiped out a lot of other things, too. But I think, like you said, like Scott said, the biggest extinction, I think, was the end Permian. Yeah, like you said, that was a very big one.
Scott, anything to add to that?
Yeah, each extinction sort of had their own flavors. What contributed to the extinctions in many cases appeared to be abrupt shifts in the climate. Save for the end of the dinosaurs, which, of course, everyone knows about the giant asteroid, but it turns out that may have been sort of the final nail in the coffin of a series of bad events involving climate change, volcanism, and just a lot of bad things happening all at once.
Yeah. Ross in Belleville, we'll give you a chance to join in. Thanks for calling.
Well, thanks, Larry. I was wondering, I do a lot of hiking around in the Bearwood Bluffs, which supposedly are the oldest mountains in Wisconsin, or former mountains, and they're made out of quartzite. So does that quartzite contain any fossils in it?
No, unfortunately, it doesn't. We can't see any body fossils or anything in that quartzite, largely because they predate the multicellular fossil record. But in areas sort of like Abelman's Gorge, which is in Rock Springs, Wisconsin, really nearby, and some of the bluffs around Devil's Lake State Park, you can see ripple marks. That is the sculpted sand from that ancient ocean, which dates to about 1.7 billion years ago. So you could walk on an ancient beach that has been heated and compressed and converted into quartzite today.
Wow. Russ, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Rose emailed, their favorite fossil is the crinoid or crinoid?
Crinoid.
Crinoid?
Yes.
I'll go with that, yeah.
So explain that, crinoid. What was...
Yeah, those were the closest. Well, they're still alive today in the seas. They were all marine. They were all echinoderms. Echinoderms were the animals that had a spiny skin, which is what echinoderm means. But the biggest thing is they had a water vascular system, like you'd find on the bottom of a starfish, mm-hmm. which is also an echinoderm. But crinoids were stalked animals. They had a stalk that they used and mostly attached to the substrate with. Sometimes they were free-floating and some even lacked a stalk, but they had the five arms or some multiples of fives generally, sort of like a starfish would, and that's the general layout or body plan of the starfish, the water vascular system, and some multiple of five type of a symmetry.
Pretty cool. She said their favorite geologic, Rose said her favorite geological feature is the Great Uniformity by Devil's Lake. Scott, what do you know? The Great Uniformity.
Is it? I hadn't heard it referenced. No. They may be referencing an unconformity.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's exactly what she said. I just misread it.
Yeah, that makes
it.
Sense.
Great okay. Unconformity by Devil's Lake.
An unconformity is a surface where you have contiguous deposition of rock being truncated or completely cut off. And then you have a large gap in time of missing deposition so that the rocks laying on top of the ancient underlying rocks often can be a billion years apart, 2 billion years apart. And in the case of the area around Devil's Lake, all those rocks that I'd mentioned from that Baraboo quartzite date to about 1.7 billion years ago. And especially in Abelman's Gorge, you can see at the top of some of the rock outcrops, a stark transition to a sandstone filled with cobbles and rocks in it, and those date to the Cambrian period. So you're missing about 1.2 billion years of geologic history in between those two layers of rock.
Wow. Bill in Oshkosh has something for us. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, my question is, after each mass extinction, how come there's such a different group of animals that develops after that.
It's completely different. Yeah, go ahead, Scott.
That would be due to what we call niche vacating. In other words, you have certain animals that made a living where they lived, how they lived. For example, in the ocean, were they on top of the seafloor? Did they burrow into it? That once you have a mass extinction, many of those organisms that occupy that lifestyle have disappeared. So they get replaced by novel species that are exploiting that now available resource. So a good example between the dinosaurs and today would be things like pack hunters like the raptors or the solitary predators like T-Rex would be replaced by mammals later, things like pack hunting wolves or a solitary lion or some sort of animal that doesn't really hunt in large groups. So that's why you see a mass diversity shortly following any sort of mass extinction. The greater the extinction and larger loss of life, usually the more novel things you see in the immediate aftermath.
And I think that filling the niches is the biggest thing. But also, if you're looking at it from a micro level, just looking at, like, for example, the Devonian of Wisconsin, there are some little minor areas where there has been, the sea has withdrawn and there wasn't any more deposition of rock, of material. And then it came back again. And when it came back, it might have brought back a little bit different, and this is sort of another kind of an unconformity. It brought back a different mixture of the animals. It wasn't the same thing. They maybe not have been species that were new, but they may have been new to the area or in a different relative abundance. So you can see a pretty big, just in fact, in Estabrook Park in Milwaukee, where I've done a whole lot of work, you can see that happening. You can look at one layer. You can see a little area, a plane of contact between the two stratas, that show that there was some dissolution, some dissolving of the sediment surface, so you know that the sea withdrew then and then it came back again. And you can see a different proportion of the animals that, did come back. So that's not really a matter of evolution. It's just a matter of migration, basically coming back and where they had picked up some other species from other sources of water that came in, of currents or whatever that came in.
So these continental movements, too, must have affected the sort of the distribution and evolution of marine and land life.
Absolutely. Yeah, as the continents moved, there were ocean basins that became completely isolated. So it would be, if imagined, sea level drops, and there ends up being a land bridge that connects Florida through to Cuba down to Mexico. You would have a separate isolated basin now where evolution can take place in its own little environment within the Gulf of Mexico versus the rest of the Atlantic proper. And we see events like that having occurred across Wisconsin, and that is reflected in the fossil record. We'll see isolation. You can see certain species go extinct while new ones migrate in. There are quite a few events like that that occur in our rock layers. You just have to kind of know what to look for.
Yeah. And somebody else emailed in wondering if you could talk more, Scott, about your research, your graduate research, more about that. You mentioned it kind of in passing.
I did, yes. I was studying rocks under Dr. Margaret Fraser when she was at UW-Milwaukee, and I was looking at rocks in the immediate aftermath of the end Permian mass extinction. So that was the Great Dying, where lots of species were entirely wiped out. And I did study little shell-bearing creatures called brachiopods. They happen to be my favorite things in the fossil record. They're enormously diverse. They superficially resemble clams, although their symmetry is a little different. And they were exclusively marine. And their diversity made them a really good test subject for watching things like mass extinction, because they sort of serve as the canary in the coal mine. When conditions go south, then you'll see the populations among this really once diverse group of organisms shift. Some species that had once been dominant or common go extinct. Other ones show up. And in the case of the end Permian mass extinction, they transition from being once the most dominant shell-bearing organism in the Paleozoic oceans. So that would mean if you were walking on a beach, instead of finding clams and snails, almost all the shells would be brachiopods, to being relegated to the deep seas and really harsh environments immediately after the extinction. So they're just really a fascinating little creature that tells you an awful lot about the environments at that time, especially important given that the end Permian mass extinction is largely attributed to runaway global warming.
Rick in Rhinelander has a couple of questions for us, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Rick.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had a question. You had mentioned quartzite in the Baraboo Bluffs still showing the ripple marks from ancient oceans. I've been out west and seen that in sandstone. But I'm curious, is the quartzite, was that previously sand, and then you said it was heating and compression and still retained its ripples? What is the process that by which that occurred, and is that how quartzite is formed? Now, my second question is the iron deposits up in the UP. I've been told that the reason they're there, they were pure iron by Ishpeming, was due to the composition of the ocean actually changing from sort of a oxygenated ocean to a reductive ocean that allowed that pure iron to kind of precipitate out. I was wondering about that as well.
Okay, a couple of questions. Scott, maybe start with you.
Sure, I can address the quartzite. So quartzite is a metamorphic rock. It does occur when you have sandstone getting compressed, heated by tectonic forces in the case of Wisconsin. Around 1.8 billion years ago, there were a series of islands that were sort of rafting their way to the continental margin where present-day Wisconsin is. And as these little island masses and other marine sea floor started to pile onto the continent, it folded it up and created these series of what we call anticlines and synclines, these up and down sort of undulating layers of rock. And it's that compression that converted the once sandstone and heated it and formed it into quartzite. But it did manage to preserve the ripples. It wasn't so heavily altered that we lost that detail. So we're really fortunate to have those deposits.
Yeah, and Ken, maybe you can talk about,
yeah,
or add to that.
those ripple marks are really abundant in Wisconsin in the Cambrian rocks. The ones at Blackberry Hill, which is, I've written a book about that. They're, again, most of that rock is sandstone, but a lot of it has been metamorphosed a little bit, so it's now orthoquartzite, which is a type of quartzite produced by metamorphism of sandstone. So we do have a lot of ripples, really beautiful, bizarre-looking ripples of all different patterns. And it's called the Elk Mound Group of Wisconsin, which is about a half a billion years old. That's the one that preserves the oldest animals ever found that walked on land. Were found, discovered right there in central Wisconsin in the Elk Mound Group.
And the iron deposits, Rick had a question about the iron and how it was formed and so forth. Is his supposition correct as to the water creating? Go ahead, Scott.
I'm not entirely sure of the processes that contributed specifically to those iron deposits, but during that time period when those rocks were forming, oxygen levels in the atmosphere and subsequently in the ocean itself dissolved into it were far lower. And so iron could be dissolved into the ocean waters without precipitating out. And it's only when oxygen levels started to increase in the atmosphere by activity of things like those stromatolites, that cyanobacteria, that it would cause the iron to precipitate out and form hematite layers on the sea floor. And so many of the layers you see in north-central Wisconsin and parts that extend up into those iron ranges into the Ishpeming area of Michigan are comprised of banded rock that has rust layers from when the bacteria was converting that iron in the water into true hematites and depositing it, and black layers that aren't oxidized, and that happens when the bacteria actually kill themselves off. Oxygen was toxic to those earliest organisms forming those iron stones back then. So I do know at least that's the history of some of those rocks in that area. As to what contributed all the rest of the iron, that may be the case or may not be.
Yeah. I was thinking about northern Wisconsin. I can remember being in the Shawabigan National Forest with some folks, and we were using compasses to travel from, you know, hopefully straight north or whatever. I don't remember the direction, but one of the guys was maybe 100 steps over from me, and I said, all right, straight north. And he had it one way, and I had another, and I said, wait a minute, there's a lot of iron in the earth in the northern Wisconsin, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
it was really something compare our compasses for sure. Ken Gass, one of our guests today, honorary curator at the Milwaukee Public Museum. Scott Schaefer, interim director of the Weiss Earth Science Museum at UW Oshkosh. I'm Larry Mailer. You're listening to WPR News. Great to have you along today as we take a look way, way, way back in Wisconsin to the Paleozoic area with our two guests, Ken Gass, honorary curator at Milwaukee Public Museum, and Scott Schaefer, interim director of the Weiss Earth Science Museum at UW Oshkosh, Fox City's campus. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. And Ken, I thought you mentioned Blackberry Hill sort of in passing. Can you talk a little bit more? Where is it? What's important about it?
Sure. That's the one that I touched on before. It's Cambrian in age, the rock that's there. It's probably, in my opinion, it's the most significant discovery in paleontology in the state's history. What it does, it solves a mystery that was going on since the 1800s, the middle 1800s, in the times of Charles Darwin and Richard Owen, the guy who made up the word dinosaur. He also named the first footprints that were given an official name called Protychnites. And nobody knew what the animal was that made those. But all we did know is that whatever the animal was that made those footprints were the first animals to walk on land. And the animal was evasive up until a discovery at Black Bear Hill, Wisconsin, which is about in Mosinee area, a little bit outside of, it's called Gunther. Actually, the town of Gunther is what is really nearest. And it's a series of quarries that contain the ripples that I was talking about,
yeah,
and the first animals to walk on land, and the footprints that they made, and even fossils that showed the animal making those footprints. And that's kind of how we know that was what the proof was, that we knew what the animal was that made them. So we've discovered after 150 years what the first animal was to walk on land. In other words, the first one to take the first steps out of the sea and mm-hmm. actually start to move around, only in a basically an amphibious state where they would return back to the water. Maybe they're trying to make it from one tide pool to another. Because this was the intertidal and the supertidal, and even up into the dunes, the high and dry in the dunes that they were walking. Mm. So that was a big thing about the Cambrian in Wisconsin, except for there's another big thing in Wisconsin that, and a lot of other discoveries were made at Black Bear Hill as well.
Yeah.
But then there was another thing, that these things called the glaspidids, which were another type of arthropod animal that was segmented, and more of those have been found in Wisconsin than anywhere else. And those were, it's been called a glaspidid central, in fact, Wisconsin sometimes is called, because of that. And that's another thing. But going back to Blackberry Hill, in the same period, the Cambrian period, Blackberry Hill also had the largest and the first mass strandings of jellyfish in the fossil record. And so that was another big thing. So I don't want to go into too much detail because, as I mentioned, I talked about the Cambrian and two other programs on here before, and yeah. I could go off for hours on end about the discoveries made there.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting. How did the, adaptations did the creatures have to make to, you know, the first ones that stepped out of the water?
Well, the ones that stepped out of the water, if they couldn't get back to the water or couldn't get to a tide pool or some other place where they wouldn't dry out and they wouldn't die, then they would die if they would, if they didn't have the kinds of appendages or ambulation required to move around enough. So that was the one thing about these things. They were called euthycarcinoids is what the animals were. And their legs weren't really, really well suited for walking very well, but good enough to get them from one tide pool to another or back to the ocean. So we think that that was the transition that happened to this amphibious lifestyle that enabled them to develop and adapt and develop into eventually fully terrestrial, one of the fully terrestrial kinds of animals. Of course, many kinds of animals came out of the sea at different times, but as far as the arthropods go, this may have been close to the animals, the first animals that really did become fully terrestrial, which were the another kind of an arthropod, basically millipedes. And and then, of course, the fish came much later. They started back in the Devonian period, which was like three periods after the Cambrian. So we think of, if you look at the internet and look up what was the first animal to walk on land, you're going to find fish, Tiktaalik or something like that. But they weren't. The euthycarcinoids in Wisconsin were coming, doing that way over 100 million years before that. So
We were first.
We were. We had the first ones to show what the animal was.
John in Port Wing, let's go to you now. Hi, John.
Hi. I've got a question about fossil identification. Is there a resource where the public could send photos of fossils and get some kind of a possible identification?
Scott, go ahead.
Yeah, there's a couple places to be able to do that. There is a public forum online. It's called the Fossil Forum. They're pretty good at that. I used to frequent that website as well, but we even have at the museum our website. We have an info WESM website, so it's info WESM @gmail.com, and the public often submits rock and fossil identifications to that website. We also host at the museum occasionally a rock identification day, where we encourage the public to bring in their treasures, and we love going through what they have found and identifying things for them.
That's pretty
cool.
There's
multiple resources.
Ken, is the Milwaukee Public Museum involved in any of that, do you know, or that sort of thing?
I'm not sure what official things that they have to accommodate that, but I think that that I know that the curators at the museum, Pat Burke, who works there, she's the main curator. She gets a lot of requests from people. I'm sure she gets a lot of photographs sent to her and other things. But there might be something more official than that. I'm just not really aware of what that is. That's not part of the things that I've done for them.
for them over time. So what do you think about the research itself? How does understanding, I asked both of you to comment on this, what does understanding what happened back then help us today?
Extinctions happen.
Just knowing.
I'm not asking a question, I'm giving an answer.
Yeah.
to me, what fossils tell us is that if we're not careful, we could be one of them. The extinction does happen. And that's something that I'm reminded of every time I pick up a fossil. And I think we can pick that up and use that in our lives to remember that what we're doing on this planet makes a difference, because the planet is always changing. We may or may not be here depending on what we do.
Well said. Scott, comment from you.
A phrase that you often hear out of geologists is that the past is the key to the present. So not only can we track things like environmental change and extinctions and how they affect the organisms, but what it allows us to do is something we cannot do in the present. If something does cause a mass extinction, not only can we see the record and climate data that we can get from the rocks and population counts from the species in the fossil record, but we can see that before the extinction, as it's setting up, as the extinction is in full swing, and even after the extinction, the aftermath. And so the rock record, for many reasons, is one of the best ways that we can make sense of what is going on our planet today and try to predict some future effects of what is going on, in this case, like things like climate change.
Yeah, that's... how do you guys look at climate change? Given the history that you've studied your careers,
well, I know
very
that
carefully.
Yeah, very carefully, and I know that there are several things happening. We are still sort of coming out of the last ice age, so there's a little bit of warming and raising of sea levels coming from that. But starting with the Industrial Revolution, it was either a really big coincidence or something is happening that we're doing that's making that accelerate.
Yeah. Scott?
It serves as sort of a cautionary tale. Because we can track things in the aftermath of an extinction, it lets us know really what level of impact we're having. Right now, if you were to look at the rock record between today and going to as far back as 40 or 50,000 years ago, that package of rock in the present is something that we could say, okay, we're recording 50,000 years of time here. But if you were to travel back and look at the packages of rock from the Devonian period, a span of time like 40 or 50,000 years would look almost instantaneous as a strata of rock in, say, the Devonian or the Silurian. And so the effects that we're having today, such as, extinction of some of the larger fauna, for example, everyone cites the polar bear is critically endangered because of melting sea ice. Well, in the rock record itself, things like the disappearance of the woolly mammoth and the mastodon or the scimitar-toothed cat would all look almost instantaneous if we were to transport ourselves 10 million years into the future. And so understanding the rapidity of these extinctions is something that I think has the biggest consequence for us and the most important thing with what we're looking at today.
Ken, Scott, thank you both so much for being with us today. It was a quick hour, and hopefully we can do this again. Ken Gass is honorary curator at Milwaukee Public Museum. Scott Schaefer, Interim Director of the Wise Earth Science Museum at UW Oshkosh Fox City's campus. Thank you for listening in today. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.